This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Joining me on the Jodcast today is Professor Paul Crowther from the University of Sheffield. Hello and welcome to the Jodcast.
Hello, pleased to be here.
You work on massive stars or monster stars. Can you tell us a little bit about your research and what you mean by this?
Yeah, so most stars in the universe, certainly the Milky Way, where we can actually see low-mass stars, most stars are less massive than the Sun. And they're dwarf stars, and so they're smaller than the Sun, less luminous than the Sun, and their lifetime is longer than the Sun. So a star with a mass below the Sun's mass will have lifetimes of tens or even hundreds of billions of years. So they're the most common stars out there, but they're also the kind of faintest. Whereas I kind of work on the stars at the opposite extreme in mass range. Stars which have masses of, say, 100 solar masses or even more. And these stars are the rarest stars. They're also the brightest stars, so they might shine a million or even sometimes maybe even 10 million times brighter than the Sun, which means we can see them quite far away. And they also have the shortest lifetimes, and the lifetimes of the most massive stars is measured in only a few million years rather than billions of years like the Sun.
Is there a limit to how big a star can be?
Well, that's something that I'm trying to look into right now. There's certainly a limit to the lower mass end, and that's kind of the division between brown dwarfs below something like 80 Jupiter masses or just below a tenth of a Sun's mass. So it's definitely a lower mass limit. At the upper mass end, as far as we can tell, we seem to find a few stars with masses of 100, 200, just about maybe 300 solar masses. But above that, we've looked and we haven't really seen anything above that. So it might just be that stars with masses of 1,000 solar masses may just not exist. But they might not exist because they're not allowed to exist, but because of the way stars form. Stars tend to form in clusters. They tend to form out of a collapsing, cold, dense gas cloud. And so because they're forming together, it might just be that they're kind of competing for the same amount of gas. And massive stars have to accrete really quickly because their lifetimes are so short. And in fact, they probably have to accrete all their mass within only 100,000 years or so.
So by accrete, you mean gain mass?
Gain mass. So the way that we think star formation happens is that we think a cold, dense gas cloud kind of collapses and fragments into kind of down to kind of tiny seeds, and those seeds might be as low in mass as, I don't know, 10 Jupiter masses or something. And then when those seeds stop fragmenting, they can then build up mass by accreting, and little guys might accrete over a very long time. You know, the Sun might have formed in 10 million years, whereas these high-mass stars have to accrete have to grab a lot of gas in a very short amount of time. And it might just be that they don't exceed a certain limit, not because they can't, but because they're really all competing for the same reservoir of cold, dense molecular gas.
In the Milky Way, our own galaxy, do we have any really good measurements on how massive a star could be?
Yeah, so the Milky Way is forming stars, and it's forming stars at a rate of something like one solar mass per year at the moment. But it's doing it in kind of pockets of star-forming regions, and the Orion Nebula cluster is the youngest nearby high-mass star-forming region. But the most massive star in Orion, which is quite a small region, is a few tens of solar masses. Where there are other regions, both in the spiral arms and in the center of the Milky Way, where we have much more impressive star clusters have just formed. I would say the best place with the most accurate stellar masses for the most massive stars is a region in a southern sky called NGC 3603. And this is a region which has probably formed 20,000 stars over the last million years or so. And this happens to have a close binary system, in other words, two stars very close together, which are in orbit around each other. And what's good about it is we can see both stars in their light and in their spectra, and we can see them orbiting each other, and they eclipse each other. And so we can actually get very accurate masses for those stars. And the star's masses comes out to be more or less 100 solar masses for each star. And that is a pretty accurate dynamically derived mass. And that's the most accurate masses we have for the most massive stars in the Milky Way.
So if more massive stars are rarer, and they need bigger cluster sizes from which to form, where would we go looking for these?
Where we want to look for the most massive stars, we need to find, you're right, that we need to find massive clusters, but ones which are nearby so we can resolve the stars, and ones which are young, because the lifetimes of these stars are so short that if we find a cluster that's 10 million years old, the highest mass star has already died. So we have to find massive, young, nearby star clusters. And so actually there are better places to look than our own Milky Way.
So nearby galaxies?
So nearby galaxies. So in fact, the nearest big star forming region in our own galactic neighbourhood is actually within the large Magellanic Cloud. Again, another object we can see from the southern sky. So it's quite close, and it's this giant star-forming region, which is maybe 100 times bigger than the Orion Nebula in physically terms, and it's actually about 1,000 times intrinsically brighter. So it's much bigger and brighter than the Orion Nebula. It's just 100 times further away. And in the centre of that star-forming region, there's a real heavyweight star cluster with some very massive stars in it in the centre.
And do massive stars tend to, while they form in clusters, do they tend to form by themselves, or they form together with other companion stars?
So I would say we probably used to think that most formed on their own within these clusters, but I would say more recent work in the last few years seems to find that they actually more or less, most of them are formed in a binary system with another member. Now, again, when we used to think of massive stars, we thought most formed with equal mass binaries, in other words, two stars around the same mass. In fact, it turns out that there's a wide spread of relative masses, and so a 100 solar mass star might form as equally on its own, or with a 10 solar mass companion, or a 100 solar mass companion. So there's a whole range of possibilities.
Do we know how they form?
I would say there are issues relating to star formation in general, actually, how you end up with these very, very tenuous cold regions ending up with the dimensions and densities of stars. But it's especially hard for high mass stars, partly because they're so rare, which means they're far away, which means they're hard to see when they're forming. And when they're forming, and they form so quickly, they're formed within these dense, dusty gas regions. And so it's very hard to see, to probe down to the region where the actual star is forming, and the protostar is getting between the cold, dense gas cloud to the main sequence as it burns hydrogen on the main sequence. And the complication with high mass stars is that when these stars get relatively hot at their surface, they kind of inherently drive away material. So you have this balance between trying to accrete mass to build up in mass, but also at the same time, it's kind of drive, when it gets hot, its radiation pressure is driving away stuff. So it's kind of the complication with high mass stars that they form quickly, and that they're, you kind of wonder how they can build up to masses of 50 or 100 or more solar masses.
But theoretically, there's no fixed limit on how big they could grow.
I don't think there's a fixed limit from a theoretical perspective. I think the reality is, though, that since they form in these cold, dense regions, I think they are, in the end, competing for a finite amount of fuel, you know, of material. And so what we tend to often find is that the highest mass members of a star cluster, whether it be in Orion, or whether it be in this giant stellar nursery in the LMC, we tend to find that the highest mass stars in the center. And that's because if they formed in the center, then they had the ability to accrete the most material, which is, again, sitting in the center of this protocluster.
On the other end of the lifetime, we're kind of familiar with the idea that massive stars explode as a supernova, then create a black hole. Will these monster stars have a similar death?
Yeah, so the deaths of let's say most stars in the universe, ones below about 10 times the mass of a sun, is basically a kind of, they go up with a whimper, really, where they kind of fade away as a white dwarf. The stars above probably about 8 or 9 times the mass of a sun, we think mostly they get to a point where they end up with iron in the centers, and they undergo what we call core collapse, which means that the core collapses down to a neutron star and might in the end accrete mass to produce a black hole. And then there's a corresponding supernova explosion from the envelope of the star, which produces what we call a type 2 supernova with hydrogen, or sometimes a type 1 supernova without hydrogen. But it may be that some of these real monster stars die in quite a different way and produce what we call a superluminous supernovae, where the conditions in the center near the end of their life, when you get what's called electrons and positrons, these tiny particles forming through basically the high temperatures in their cores. And that, in principle, could allow these stars to blow up a very bright supernovae and not leave a neutron star or black hole behind.
So is there any remnants we could be looking for to see evidence of these past?
Yeah, so there have been claims of such that some of the very bright supernovae we've seen in the last few years were such objects. But I would say the evidence within the last year or two suggests that maybe there weren't these very exotic supernovae. It may be that they're very bright for a different reason. So I'd say right now the jury's out as to whether such objects have been seen, but it's likely actually that these weird supernovae, very bright supernovae, which didn't leave anything behind, might have actually occurred in the early universe. The first stars, we think, had a characteristic mass much higher than that of stars forming now in the Milky Way. And we think that rather than a typical star having a mass of half that of the Sun, it may have had a mass of 10 or even 100 times the mass of a Sun. And those guys might have blown up through these, some of those might have blown up in this very exotic bright supernova.
Can I ask you now a bit more about the methods you do to sort of weigh these stars in general? Because they're very, very hot. And if we look at their signatures, how do we differentiate them from another, let's say, less massive star?
Yeah, so it's not easy because if you think about the Sun, most of its energy comes out in the optical, so we can see its light because it's coming out primarily in the visible part of the spectrum. Cool stars, their energy peaks in the infrared, so objects like Betelgeuse, red giants, red supergiants. Whereas hot stars and massive stars spend most of the time as blue stars. Most of their energy comes out in the ultraviolet, or even a lot of those stars primarily in the what we call the extreme ultraviolet. And so we can't, unfortunately, see that energy because it gets absorbed by the interstellar hydrogen. So we have to be kind of smart as to how we figure out how hot they are, and then if we know how far away they are, to work out how luminous they are, and then to work out how massive they are. So it's various steps we use. And for the massive stars, we use the not so much the continuum output, which is basically very little compared to the total output, but we use basically the conditions in their atmospheres that we can infer based on their spectra. So we take spectra, whether it be in the ultraviolet or from space, and the optical from the ground or in the infrared, and the features we see in the spectra, that allows us to work out a temperature, and then if you know how far away it is, works out a luminosity, and then we generally compare that with a model to work out its current mass, and then roll that back to its initial mass.
So that's what we use for the more distant objects.
When we're looking at objects, it's actually easier sometimes doing that for objects in other galaxies compared to those in the Milky Way, because actually until Gaia has done its survey, we don't know distances to very remote objects in the Milky Way very well. And actually we know distances to objects in nearby galaxies actually much better than we do to many objects in our own Milky Way. And the other complication is that, of course, these things, the hot things, are emitting most of the light in the ultraviolet. And the ultraviolet is a part of the spectrum or the energy output of stars, which if there's dust between that object and us, it means that light gets absorbed by the dust between it and us, which means that actually, and because we're in the Milky Way's disk, which is full of dust, actually it turns out that it's really hard getting ultraviolet information on hot stars in the Milky Way. Whereas, for example, looking at, say, hot stars in the Magellanic Clouds, which is out of our galactic disk, actually we can get much easier access from space to the ultraviolet light of such stars, because even though they're much further away, so they're fainter, there's not that dust in the way.
Is there a way for even more distant galaxies just to use their combined light to see how massive an object may be?
Yeah, so it's really tough to try and... I mean, it's hard enough working out the properties of an individual star in a resolved star cluster, which is nearby. Some work I've been doing, which is using Hubble, looking at the ultraviolet light of individual stars in a resolved cluster, when I kind of look at the contribution to that integrated light of the star cluster from individual stars, it turns out that there are kind of features which only the most massive young stars show. And so when we look at then an unresolved, more distant star cluster in another galaxy, there's kind of a hint maybe that we can use the presence or absence of certain spectral features to actually say that this young cluster has or hasn't got very massive stars within it.
So in summary, to find the most massive stars, we need to have a big star-forming cluster that has to be relatively young, in fact, very young.
Very young, yeah.
And still quite close by.
Ideally close by, so we can actually see the individual stars. But there's a hint that we might be able to get information about the most massive stars, because they're the brightest stars. So even though they're the rarest, they're actually the brightest stars in that star cluster. So the few brightest stars in any young cluster, the few brightest, few most massive stars dominate the light, actually. So, I mean, for example, in the star cluster in the LMC that I've obtained ultraviolet observations of with Hubble, I looked at the 100 brightest stars, and it turns out maybe the 10 brightest stars contribute half the light to the entire cluster. So actually the few brightest ones really are real beacons, because you know, their luminosities are, you know, many millions of times brighter than the sun.
So finally, I want to ask you a bit of an outlier question. What odds do you think you will have on finding a star above 200 solar masses in the next 10 years or so?
Well, we think we found a few which were probably that sort of mass when they were born. So a few objects in the LMC, a few objects maybe in the Milky Way. But the challenge is that with the big new telescopes, with James Webb and with the ELT coming online in the next decade, of course, the natural next step would be to look not in the Milky Way or the imaginary clouds, but to look at the brightest stars in, for example, Andromeda or in M33, because that's an order of magnitude further away than the imaginary clouds. But the problem is there aren't really any super bright young star clusters in those galaxies. So unfortunately, for us to really make progress in terms of advancing this subject, we have to go an order of magnitude again in distance out to kind of many millions of light years away. So my suspicion is that we have to make do with what we have right now, and to get more observations of relatively nearby objects to establish whether they're binaries maybe, or to see if they are single, or maybe even if they built up their mass not through them being born massive, but actually whether they've undergone a stellar merger. And that's a possibility.
That's brilliant. Thank you very much for talking to me today.
Pleasure.